Timescape, Cassette 9.
Chapter 31. Markham spread his working papers out on the narrow little drop tray the airline provided. He had hours of boring Atlantic crossing ahead, jammed in next to the window. Cathy Wickham's equations swam before him, tensor indices beckoning to be turned this way and that, a dense notation compacted with promise. "Lunch, sir?" the professionally blank-faced steward muttered. This echo of politeness was to put a gloss on his casual dumping of a cardboard package on the drop table. Markham pried open the wedged boards. A rain of packets thumped down among his papers. They were the now universal, easy-for-them modular units of food. He unwrapped one and found it to be the obligatory rubber chicken. He bit in reluctantly. Pasty, sour stuff. The only saving grace in this was the absence of plastic packaging, he thought. The bombing of the Saudi field several years ago had brought an abrupt end to that, and a return to humble cardboard. The pulpy grey surface of the package recalled his boyhood, before hydrocarbons ruled the world. The humanizing side of paper containers was the simple fact that they accepted the touch of a pen, would carry a message. Plastic sheen rejected the imprint of its temporary users. Idly, he jotted the new quantum field equations on the lunchbox. The elegant epsilons and deltas made their stately march across the United Airlines block letters. He chewed absently. Time passed. Markham saw a way to separate the tensor elements into several reduced equations. With descending strokes, he paired off field components. He jotted side calculations to check himself. Other passengers moved in the distance. In a while, the five new equations lay aslant on the ribbing of cardboard. Three, he suspected, were old friends, the Einstein equations with modifications for quantum effects when the length scale became small enough. These were well known. The other two seemed to imply more. A deeper sense of the quantum effects added a fresh term here, a tangle of tensors there. There seemed no way to reduce the system further. Markham tapped idly at them with his pen, frowning. "Say, give!" the man next to him cried out. Markham peered out of his window. An immense cloud, sulphurous yellow and veined with orange, hung ahead of them. "First I've seen," the man said excitedly. Markham wondered if the pilot would fly through it. In seconds, the window was hazed by strands of cloud, and Markham realized that they were already passing through a lower segment of the yellow mass ahead. Fresh weight tugged him down. The plane tilted to rise.
"Right ahead of us, folks, is one of those clouds we've been hearing about. I'm taking us over it for a better look."
This explanation seemed transparently false to Markham. Pilots didn't change altitude for a lark. The cloud seemed gravid and somehow more solid than the fluffy white cumulus around it. Threads of a coiling, dark blue wound through its cap, giving it a domed profile. Markham murmured something and went back to his papers. He copied the new equations off the cardboard and studied them, trying to screen out the thin, high wail of the engine. An engineer had once told him the new generation of superfast engines screamed at unbearable levels. Rockwell International had had to go into cost overrun to blunt the jagged spikes of sound. 6 months had been spent to bury the screech in a reassuring bass blanket, so the warm, ticketed bodies carried inside would remain woozy and complacent in the metallic grasp. Well, it didn't work for him. He had always been noise-sensitive. He found the earplugs in a flap compartment in front of him and inserted them. A blanket sealed him in. The only remnant of the engine scream was an acoustic tremor that came up through his legs and settled in his teeth. He spent an hour testing the new equations. They gave sensible solutions to limiting case problems he knew. Taking the scale length small and neglecting the gravitational effects, he got the standard equations of relativistic particle theory. Einstein's work emerged easily, with a few fluid strokes of the pen. But when Wickham's equations were taken face-on, with no sidestepping into familiar ground, they became opaque. He squinted at the short, stubby notation. If he sliced through this knot of terms here, just dropped them, but no, that wasn't right. There was more than remorseless crank-turning to be done here. The work had to have the right deft feel to glide forward on its own momentum. Beyond the logical standards, there were aesthetic questions. New developments in physics always gave you first a logical structure that was more elegant. Second, once you understood it, the structure was not only elegant, it was simpler. Third, from the structure came consequences that were more complex than before. The ever-present trap in seeking a new path was to invert the steps. It was hard to express this to a philosopher. There was something in the art of mathematics that eluded you unless you watched for it. Plato had been a great philosopher, and he had decided he wanted the planets to move in sets of circles, all compounded together to give the observed orbits. But as Ptolemy found out, the laws that were needed to give those stacked circles were horrendously complex. That would mean complex laws leading to simple consequences, the wrong way round. So all of Ptolemy's labours gave forth a theory that clanked and groaned, crystalline spheres grinding around, sprockets and wheels and ratchets whirring in a doomed machine. On the other hand, Einstein's theory was logically more elegant than Newton's. Subtle, but simple. Its consequences were much harder to work out, which was the right way round. Markham scratched his beard absently. If you kept that in mind, you could discard many approaches before you began, knowing they would ultimately fail. There was no choice between beauty and truth, really. You had to wind up with both. In art, elegance was a whore of a word, bent a different way by each generation of critics. In physics, though, there was some fragile lesson to be learned from the past millennia. Theories were more elegant if they could be transformed mathematically to other frames, other observers. A theory that remained invariant under the most general transformation was the most deft, the nearest to a universal form. Gell-Mann's SU3 symmetry had arrayed particles into universal ranks. The Lorentz group, isospin. The catalogue of properties labelled strangeness and colour and charm, they all cooked gauzy number into concrete thing. So to proceed beyond Einstein, one should follow the symmetries. Markham scratched equations across a yellow pad, searching. He'd intended to spend this time plotting his tactics with the NSF, but politics was dross compared with the actual doing of science. He tried different approaches, twisting the compacted tensor notation, peering into the maze of mathematics. He had a guiding principle. Nature seemed to like equations, stated in covariant differential forms, to find the right expressions. He worked out the equations governing tachyons in a flat space-time, doing the exercise as a limited case. He nodded. Here were the familiar quantum mechanical wave equations. Yes, he knew where they led. The tachyons could cause a probability wave to reflect back and forth in time. The equations told how this wave function would shuttle, past to future, future to past. A befuddled commuter. Making a paradox meant the wave had no ending, but instead formed some sort of standing wave pattern, like the rippling patterns around an ocean jetty, shifting their troughs and peaks, but always returning, an ordering imposed on the blank face of the churning sea. The only way to resolve the paradox was to step in, break up the pattern, like a ship cutting across the troughs, leaving a swirl of sea behind. The ship was the classical observer. But now Markham added the Wickham terms, making the equations symmetric under interchange of tachyons. He rummaged through his briefcase for the paper by Gott that Cathy had given him. Here, a time-symmetric matter and antimatter tachyon cosmology. Quite a piece of territory to bite off, indeed. But Gott's solutions were there, luminous on the page. The Wheeler-Feynman forces were there, mixing advanced and retarded tachyon solutions together with non-Euclidean sums. Markham blinked. In his cottony silence, he sat very still, eyes racing, imagination leaping ahead to see where the equations would fold and part to yield up fresh effects. The waves still stood mutely confused, but there was no role left for the ship, for the classical observer. The old idea in conventional quantum mechanics had been to let the rest of the universe be the observer, let it force the waves to collapse. In these new tensor terms, though, there was no way to regress, no way to let the universe as a whole be a stable spot from which all things were measured. No, the universe was coupled in firmly. The tachyon field wired each fragment of matter to every other. Hooking more particles into the network only worsened things. The old quantum theorists from Heisenberg and Bohr on had let in some metaphysics at this point, Markham remembered. The wave function collapsed, and that was the irreducible fact. The probability of getting a certain solution was proportional to the amplitude of that solution inside the total wave. So in the end, you only got a statistical weighting of what would come out of an experiment. But with tachyons, that dab of metaphysics had to go. The Wickham terms. Sudden motion caught his eye. A passenger in the next row was clutching at a steward, eyes glassy. His face was laced with pain. A stretched mouth, pale lips, brown teeth. Mottled pink splotched his cheeks. Markham pulled his earplugs. A brittle scream startled him. The steward got the man down on the floor in the middle of the aisle and pinned his frantically clawing hands.
I can't breathe!
The steward murmured something comforting. The man shook with a seizure, eyes rolling. Two stewards carried him past Markham. He noticed an acrid smell coming from the sick man and wrinkled his nose, forcing his glasses upwards. The man panted in the enameled light. Markham replaced his plugs. He settled again into the embalming quiet, conscious only of the reassuring hum of the engines. Without peaks and valleys of sound, the world had a stuffed, spongy feel, as though Maxwell's classical ether were a reality, could be sensed at the fingertips. Markham relaxed for a moment, reflecting on how much he loved this state. Concentration on an intricate problem could loft you into an insulated, fine-grained perspective. There were many things you could see only from a distance. Since childhood, he had sought that feeling of slipping free, of being smoothly remote from the compromised churn of the world. He had used his oblique humor to distance people. Yes, keep them safely away from the center of where he lived. Even Jan, sometimes. You had to form for yourself a lucid language for the world, to overcome the battering of experience, to replace everyday life's pain and harshness and wretched dreariness with, no, not with certainty, but with an ignorance you could live with. Deep ignorance, but still a kind that knew its limits. The limits were crucial. Galileo's blocks gliding across the marble Italian foyers, their slick slide obeying inertia's steady hand. They were cartoons of the world, really. Aristotle had understood in his gut the awful fact that friction ruled, all things groaned to a stop. That was the world of man. Only the childlike game of infinite planes and smooth bodies, reality unwrinkled, cast a web of consoling order, infinite trajectories, harmonic life. From that cartoon world it was always necessary to slip back, cloaking exhilarating flights in a respectable, deductive style. But that didn't mean when the papers appeared in their disguise of abstracts and Germanic mannerisms that you had not been to that other place, the place you seldom spoke of. He paused in the impacted hush, and then went on. He wondered distantly if his first guess was right. These new Wickham equations allowed no way out of the paradox, because the whole universe was swept into the experiment. The consequence of setting up the standing wave was to send tachyons forward and backward in time, yes, but also to spray them at super-light speeds throughout the entire universe. Within an instant, every piece of matter in the universe learned of the paradox. The whole structure of space-time became woven into one piece instantly. That was the new element with tachyons. Until their discovery, physics assumed that disturbances in the space-time metric had to propagate outwards at light speed. Markham realized he had been hunched forward, scribbling mathematical statements of these ideas. His back stabbed him with small, hot knives. His writing hand protested with a sweet ache. He leaned backward, reclining the seat. Below, he saw the slate-gray plain of the sea like a giant blackboard for God's idle equations. A freighter ploughed a wake that curved with the currents, silver in the sun. They were descending towards Dulles International on a gentle, long parabola. Markham smiled with serene fatigue. The problems caught you up and carried you along, unminding currents. Was there any way to resolve the paradox? He knew intuitively that here lay the heart of the physics, the way of showing whether you could reach the past in a rigorous way. Peterson's laconic bank vault note proved something had happened. But what? Markham twisted uncomfortably, irked by the narrow, cramped seat. Air travel was getting to be a rich man's route again, only this time without the perks. Then he fetched his mind back from these passing reminders of the relentlessly real world. The problem was not solved, and time remained. But is the paradox decidable at all? He thought. The German mathematician Gödel had shown that even simplest systems of arithmetic contained things which were true but unprovable. In fact, you couldn't even show that arithmetic itself was consistent, that is, didn't contain paradoxes. Gödel had forced arithmetic into describing itself in its own language. He had trapped it into its own box, deprived it of ever proving itself by reference to things outside itself. And that was for arithmetic, the simplest logical system known. What of the universe itself, with tachyons launching through it, threading the cloth of space-time? How could all the squiggles on all the yellow pads in the world ever trap that vast weave into the old boxes of yes-stroke-no, true-stroke-false, past-stroke-future? Markham relaxed in his brimming warmth. The plane went clunk and tilted earthward. The point that continued to puzzle him was whether Renfrew needed to send a message at all, to make a paradox. Tachyons were constantly being produced by natural collisions of high-energy particles. That's how they've been discovered. Why didn't those natural tachyons produce a paradox somehow? He frowned. The plane nosed further, giving the illusion of hanging over the lip of a pit, legs dangling. Natural tachyons. The answer had to be that it took some minimum impulse to trigger a paradox. Some critical volume of space-time had to be tweaked, and then the disturbance would propagate outward instantaneously with enough amplitude to matter. You could change the past at will, yes, so long as you didn't make paradoxes that had large amplitude. Once you exceeded the threshold, the tachyon wave would have a significant impact on the whole universe. But if so, how could you tell that that had happened? What was the signature? How did the universe pick a way to resolve the paradox? They knew they'd reached the past. Peterson proved that. But what more could happen? Markham felt a sudden stab of perception. If the universe was a wholly linked system, with no mythical classical observer to collapse the wave function, then the wave function did not have to collapse at all. A wrenching thump. Markham looked out in surprise and saw the ground veer suddenly. Ahead were the patient green fields of Maryland. A clump of forest swarmed beneath the wings. In the cabin, a babble of voices, shouts, a rasping buzz. The forest went whipping by. The trees were sharp, precise with the clarity of good ideas. He watched them flick past as the airplane became light, airy, a gossamer webbing of metal that fell with him, mute matter tugged by gravity's curved geometry. Scree! The trees were pale rods in the slanting light, each with a ball of green exploding at the top. They rushed by faster and faster, and Markham thought of a universe with one wave function scattering into the new states of being as a paradox formed inside it like the kernel of an idea. If the wave function did not collapse, worlds lay ahead of him and the worlds lay behind. There was a sharp crack, and he saw suddenly what should have been. Chapter 32. Peterson woke slowly. He kept his eyes closed. His body told him not to move, but he couldn't remember why. There was a murmur of movement around him, subdued voices somewhere in the distance, a metallic clash. He opened his eyes briefly, saw white walls, a chrome rail, a whirling dizziness. He remembered where he was now. Gingerly, he tested his body, a dull, cottony feel, seeping cold ache. The rail down the side of a bed came into fuzzy focus. He rolled his head, wincing, and saw a bottle suspended above him. He tried to follow the tubes with his eyes, but couldn't. Something was plugged into his nose. A tube taped to his arm pricked him as he moved. He tried to call the nurse. It came out a rattling croak. She had heard him anyway. A round face with glasses and a white cap leaped into his field of vision.
"Waking up, are we? That's right. You'll be all right now."
"Cold."
He closed his eyes, felt blankets being tucked in around him. The plug was removed from his nose.
"Can you hold a thermometer in your mouth?"
a bright, brisk voice asked.
"Or shall we try the other end?"
He squinted at her, loathing her.
"Mouth."
His tongue felt furry and enormous. Something cold slipped into his mouth. Cool fingers clamped his wrist.
"Well, coming down nicely. You're one of the lucky ones, you are. Got you some Infolathin G before it got to you."
He frowned.
"Others?"
"Oh, yes," she said cheerfully. "We're overrun with them. No more beds at all. They're putting him in emergency now. That'll be full soon, I'll warrant. You've got a private room. But you should hear them moaning and groaning in Ward E. 60 beds they've got in there. All this funny food thing like you. Though mostly worse cases. Like I said, you're one of the lucky ones. Now, time to get some food into you."
"Food?"
he said in horror. The memory of his last dinner with Laura engulfed him in nausea.
"Nurse!"
"Going to Upchuck, are you?"
She sounded as cheerful as ever. Deftly, she fitted a kidney-shaped basin under his chin and supported his head. He retched miserably. Greenish slime trailed down his chin and left a bitter taste in his mouth. His stomach hurt like hell.
"Nothing in you, you see. Just lie still now and don't go getting excited again."
"You said food,"
he rasped accusingly. She laughed merrily.
"Well, so I did, but I didn't mean food. Time to change your IV bottle, that's all."
He closed his eyes again. His head throbbed. He heard her bustling around. Presently, the doors closed. Distantly, through double windows, he heard the hum of London's traffic. Where was he, anyway? Guy's Hospital, perhaps. He remembered more clearly now. It had come on him very suddenly. He had felt fine going home. He had waked after an hour's sleep, feeling vaguely nauseated, and had got out of bed. The clenching paralysis seized him after a few steps. He remembered lying curled on the bedroom floor, unable to call out, hardly daring to breathe. Sarah, of course, was out. He supposed he might have died if it had been the housekeeper's night off, too. When he woke, he felt more lucid. His head pulsed with a slow ache. He rang for the nurse. It was a different one, an Indian girl this time. He knew he was better when he found himself trying to gauge the size of her breasts under the starched uniform.
"How are you feeling now, Mr. Peterson?"
she asked in a sing-song voice, bending over him.
"Better. What time is it?"
"It's 5:30 now."
"I'd like my watch back, and I'm hungry. I could manage something very light."
"I'll see what's allowed," she said, and left the room silently.
He struggled into a sitting position. The nurse trotted in again with a radio and a note.
"You had a visitor, Mr. Peterson," she said, smiling. "She wouldn't stay, but she left this. And you can have some broth. It'll be up presently."
He recognized Sarah's large, graceful loops and flourishes on the envelope and opened the note.
Ian, what a terrible bore for you. Can't stand hospitals, so I won't visit, but I thought you could use this radio. I'm leaving for Cannes Friday. Hope to see you before then. If not, give me a ring. I'll probably be home Wednesday evening. Bye-bye, Sarah.
He screwed it up and dropped it in the waste paper basket. He turned on the radio, a neat little battery one. There seemed to be nothing but music anywhere. He looked automatically at his watch and realized he wasn't wearing it. What time had the nurse said it was? His stomach gurgled loudly. Three pips suddenly interrupted the music. "This is the BBC Radio 4," a woman's voice announced. "And here is the 6 o'clock news. First, the headlines. 50 people are dead tonight after violent rioting in the streets of Paris. A United Airlines flight from London to Washington crashed early this morning, killing everyone on board. The bloom, spreading across the Atlantic Ocean, has advanced miles in a day. The World Council has approved an energy plan despite a veto by the OPEC countries. Power failures lasting over 6 hours caused factories to shut down in the Midlands today. The test match at Lord's Cricket Ground was cancelled today as 10 members of the Australian team have been hospitalised with food poisoning. Tomorrow's weather, sunny in patches, increased chance of storms. A pause. Rioting French students were joined by workers today in Paris. Peterson didn't listen. He felt light and unsteady. The nurse came in with a tray. He signalled her to leave it on the bedside table. Something in the news had disturbed him, and he wasn't quite sure what it was. It must be the news of the bloom. And yet he felt no reaction as he ran that past again. United Airlines Flight 347, London to Washington, D.C., encountered turbulence on its approach to Dulles Airport and crashed in the late afternoon. Transmissions from the pilot were garbled. There seems to have been seizures of both pilot and co-pilot in the moments before the crash. Witnesses said the plane appeared to explode as it struck the trees. There were no survivors. This latest in a series of airline disasters has... Jesus! His palms were sweating. He pressed the buzzer for the nurse. She didn't come at once. He held the button down and shouted, "Nurse!" She came in hurriedly, leaving the door open.
"What's the matter now? Why, you haven't even touched your broth."
"Damn the broth! What day is this? Is it Wednesday?"
"Yes, it is, but are you..."
"I want a phone. Why isn't there a phone in here?"
"It was taken out so you wouldn't be disturbed."
"Well, get it back."
"I don't know if I'm supposed to do that.
What's going on here?"
The first nurse bustled in again.
"Sister, Mr. Peterson is asking for a phone in here."
"Oh, no, we don't need that. Don't want you to be disturbed, do we?"
"I'm being disturbed now," he shouted. "Get me a phone."
"Now, now, Mr. Peterson, we can't have that."
"Listen, you stupid cunt," he said clearly and tensely. "I want a phone in here right now, or have you fired?"
There was a shocked silence, and the two women backed from the room, eyeing him warily. He lay back, shaking. Through the door which they had left open, he could hear moaning. Presently, an orderly brought in a phone and plugged it in. Peterson took a sip of water and fought the rising nausea. He dialed his secretary's number.
Chapter 33, September 25th, 1963. Gordon was walking down the hallway on his way back to the lab when he overheard the remark. Two full professors were talking in low voices. "And as Polly said, it isn't even wrong," one finished as Gordon approached. They saw him and instantly fell silent. Gordon knew the story. Polly was a prominent, highly critical physicist in the first half of the century. He had remarked about a scientific paper, "This work is so bad, it's not even wrong." Meaning, it began and ended in midair. It was so badly formulated, it could not be tested. Gordon knew instantly they were talking about him. The Life article had done its work. When he reached the end of the hallway, there was more murmured talk behind him, and then a final bark of laughter. Penny brought home a copy of National Enquirer and left it out for him to see when he came in late. On the front page was a headline, Nuclear Call from Outer Space, and beneath it, Prominent Scientists Contact Other World. There were two photographs of Saul and Gordon, evidently by the life photographer. Gordon threw it in the trash without reading it. At the beginning of classes, there was a party for the physical sciences faculty to mark the opening of the new Institute for Geophysics building. The staff sterilized the bowl of a fountain on the lawn outside. Hugh Bradner and Harold Urey filled it with a potent mix of vodka and fruit juices. Gordon had thrown his invitation away with the usual university news notices. Penny discovered it and insisted they go. He wanted to get some rest, but her nagging made him pull on his lightest jacket and, for the first time, skip wearing a tie. In California, such details were unimportant. Penny sported a floppy tan straw hat. "For dress up," she said. Behind it, she could hide a fraction of her face. This sense of added mystery rekindled in him an interest in her. He realized that he had been going through the motions these last few weeks, saddled with lecture preparations and spending most of his time with the NMR rig. This knowledge shocked him. The zest of their beginnings was seeping away. The abrasions between them were rubbing off the cosmetic illusions. He spoke to several members of the physics department, but struck up no interesting conversations. Penny found some literary types, but he was unmoored, wandering from one knot of academics to another. The English department people already seemed drunk, quoting modern poets and ancient movies. There were bright, airy people there he'd never seen. Goy princes, blonde and unbearably self-assured, the sort of people who had refrigerators full of yogurt and champagne. He saw a visitor from Berkeley in the crowd, tall and well-dressed, a Nobel winner of some years back. Gordon had met him before. He wedged himself into the crescent of people around the man, and when the Nobel laureate's eyes shifted to him, he nodded. The eyes passed on. No nod, nothing. Gordon stood, plastic cup in hand, glassy smile on his face. The eyes came by again. No pause, no flicker of recognition. Gordon backed out of the chattering crescent, face reddening. Maybe he didn't recognize me, Gordon thought, walking away. He got himself another cup of the vodka. On the other hand, maybe he did. "Good booze, eh?" a man said at his elbow. "Try to say spectroscopy 3 times real fast." Gordon tried the exercise and failed. The man turned out to be named Book, and indeed he did look bookish. He was from General Atomic and proved to be far friendlier than the university people. They stood under a sign that proclaimed, "If you can read this, thank a teacher." None of Book's levity penetrated Gordon's mood. Vodka, however, began to relieve the world of its awful concreteness. He began to see the point in Goy's drinking so much. Book went off somewhere, and Gordon drifted into conversation with the visiting particle physicist, Steingruber. Both of them shared a deepening appreciation for the vodka. They began to discuss the ageless topic, women. Gordon made several pronouncements about Penny. In a curious way he did not quite understand, Gordon inverted their roles so that Penny had been the sexual student initiated into the adult world by himself, the sophisticate from New York. Steingruber accepted this as only reasonable. Gordon came to see that Steingruber was indeed a fine fellow, capable of profound insight. They had another drink together. Steingruber pointed to a blonde standing a short distance away and asked, "What is your opinion of that one there?" Gordon peered at her and pronounced, "Pretty cheap looking, yeah." Steingruber looked at Gordon sharply. "She's my wife." In a moment, before Gordon could frame a suitable reply, he was gone. Lakin came by, smiling amiably. He was with Bernard Carraway. "I have heard that you are repeating Cooper's experiment," Lakin said without preamble. "Who did you hear that from?" "I could see for myself." Gordon took his time. He had a swallow from his cup and discovered it was empty. Then he looked at Lakin. "Fuck off," he said very clearly. Then he walked away. He found Penny in a crowd gathered around Marcuse. "The newly appointed communist in residence?" Gordon asked when he was introduced. To his surprise, Marcuse laughed. A black woman graduate student standing nearby did not think anything was amusing. It developed that her name was Angela and that the revolution was not going to be brought about by people at cocktail parties. This was all Gordon could get out of the conversation, or at least all he could remember. He took Penny's hand and wandered away. Jonas Salk was off in a corner. Gordon debated trying to meet him. Maybe he could find out how Salk felt about Sabin. Who had really developed the vaccine? An interesting question indeed. "A parable of science," Gordon muttered to himself. "What?" Penny asked. He steered her instead toward a pack of physicists. Some nagging voice within him bid him to shut up, so he let Penny carry their fraction of the conversation. People around him seemed distant and vague. He tried to decide if this was due to him or due to them. The eternal relativistic problem. Maybe Marcuse knew the answer. Some Frenchmen asked Gordon about his experiments, and he tried to sum up what he believed. It proved surprisingly difficult. The odd thickness of his tongue had gone away, but there remained the problem of what he himself thought was true. The Frenchman asked about Saul. Gordon sidestepped the question. He tried to keep discussion focused on the results of his experiments. As Newton said, "I frame no hypotheses, at least not yet. Ask me only about data." He went off in search of more vodka, but the fountain bowl was empty. Sadly, he took the last of the crackers and the pâté. When he returned, Penny was standing a little distance away from the Frenchman, staring out at the view of La Jolla and the satiny glow of the sea. The Frenchman was speaking French. Penny seemed angry. He tugged at her, and she came along, glancing back. She insisted on driving them home, though Gordon could see no reason why he should not. Going past the beach clubs and rambling private homes, Penny said, "Those bastards," with sudden vehemence. "Huh? What?" She grimaced. "After you wandered off, they said you were a bungler." Gordon frowned. "They said that to you?" "No, silly, they started speaking French. They assumed that, of course, no American understands another language." "Oh. They called you a fake, a fraud." "Oh. They said everybody was saying that about you." "Everybody?" "Yeah," she said sourly. Chapter 34, October 7th, 1963. It came up out of the noise, suddenly. 1 minute the scope showed hash, and Gordon was tinkering with a new bandpass filter, the recent circuit he'd breadboarded to cut through the noise. Then, abruptly, the NMR curves began to warp and change. He stared at the scope, unmoving. It was 11 p.m. He brought his hand up to his lips, as if to mask a cry. The jiggling lines went on. It occurred to Gordon that he might be hallucinating. He bit his finger. No, the ragged lines remained. Quickly, suppressing his excitement beneath the urge to be precise, he began to take data. Action of Ultra Vio AMSLDUZ SUNEY DUFK OM chains appears to retard diffusion in surface layers of AMS UWL DOP, but growth RA 18536 DEC 3029.2 RA 185 FGDUEL 3029.2 RA 18536 DEC 3029.2 effects diatom enzyme inhibited B network chain repro attempt to contact you with T chionic beam WREDOPRL AL Point source can verify RA1853MCDU DEC 3029.2 RDUTFKIGLP ASLDURMFU CAMBRIDOLR Cambridge Diatom Bloom GHTUPDM ASANATH DEC 3029.2 This violates no causal postulate under Wheeler-Feynman formulation as long as feedback in causal loop permits experiment to continue. Imperative you perform experiments to check molecular chain XCDEURDL18536DEC3029.2 Time differential AUSMP. Claudia, is that you? It was the first time he had ever called her by her first name.
Yes, yes, is this Gorton?
Right. I've been running parallel with you. Were you people on last night?
What?
Were you running last night?
No, I don't... My student was making some measurements. I believe he finished about 6 o'clock.
Shit.
What? I'm sorry, I don't believe I can hear you correctly.
Sorry. Never mind. I was running last night around 11 p.m., and I got some anomalous resonance effects.
I see. Well, that would be 2 a.m. here.
Oh, yes, of course.
Now, how long did the effect last?
Over 2 hours.
Well, let me see. The student should be in soon. It is a little after 8.
Gorton, you're up at 5 a.m.?
Yes, I was waiting for you to get in.
Have you slept?
No, I was seeing if there was any more of the effect.
Gorton, go to sleep. I will talk to the student.
We will run some experiments today, but you get some sleep.
Sure, sure.
I promise you we will do the measurements, but get some sleep, eh?
Good, good. That's all I want.
Gorton, Mrs. Evelstein, she brought over the Life magazine. Now, why didn't you tell me? That was my son's name, Big as Life. As Life. And he doesn't tell me. Weeks ago it was, and...
Mom, look, I'm sorry I didn't tell you.
And the National Enquirer thing, she had that too. Now, that one I didn't like so good.
He breathed sourly into the telephone receiver.
What time was it? Christ, 5 p.m. What was the Zins group getting?
Look, Mom, I was asleep.
Asleep? At this hour?
I was working in the lab overnight.
You shouldn't. You'll ruin your health.
I'm okay.
But I wanted to say, about the Life, it was such a surprise.
Mom, I've got to go back to sleep. I'm worn out.
Well, all right. I wanted to hear your voice again, though, Gorton. I don't hear your voice so much anymore.
I know, Mom. Look, I'll call you in a few days.
All right, Gorton.
He hung up and went back to sleep. The Zins group found nothing. Gorton could not pick up the signal again. He kept checking as the week wore on. On Friday, there was a department colloquium on plasma physics given by Norman Rostocker. Gorton went and sat well in the back. Rostocker's first slide was 7 phases of the thermonuclear fusion program. 1, exaltation. 2, confusion. 3, disenchantment. 4, search for the guilty. 5, punishment of the innocent. 6, distinction for the uninvolved. 7, burying the bodies, scattering the ashes. The audience laughed. Gorton did, too. He wondered at which stage he was. But no, the whole message thing wasn't a directed research project. It was a discovery. The fact that he was the only person in the world who believed it made no difference. Search for the guilty, though, seemed to fit. He thought about it for a moment, and then in the middle of Rostocker's talk, fell asleep.
This ends side one of cassette 9. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.